Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott.
There was always a baron of beef or a shoulder or leg of lamb before my father.
That's from an opening scene of the film How Green Was My Valley, which won the Academy Award for Best Picture in 1941. That same year, another little film was snubbed from the red carpet.
Rosebud.
Orson Welles' Citizen Kane. Enraged at the title character's obvious likeness to himself, newspaper magnate William Randolph Hearst did everything in his power to destroy Citizen Kane. Although he could not prevent its release, he was able to squash its success at the box office and foil its chances for Best Picture. Hearst's attack was the first and perhaps most aggressive smear campaign in the Academy Awards' 86-year history, but there have been plenty more since. Here with a few is Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast. Hello, Marlo.
Hey, Virginia. How's it going?
Very well. Some really dirty stuff here. Funny that some of these smear campaigns do get remembered long after the ceremony, as in the case of Good Will Hunting back in 1998. What was the smear then?
Right. So this was a Harvey Weinstein film, so he wasn't behind it. But the smear was that William Goldman, writer of All the President's Men, had written it, but then he later confessed that he didn't. And then after that, Variety ran a story insinuating that Ted Talley, writer of Silence of the Lambs, wrote the screenplay, which, again, turned out to be a completely ridiculous claim. And I think just a lot of people had a hard time wrapping their head around the fact that these two boys from Boston, Matt Damon and Ben Affleck, with dimples, could churn out such a good screenplay.
Well, and I say that they get remembered because we were sitting around when we were talking about this thinking, wait, did they actually write this? You know, so these kind of things carry over. In general, who orchestrates them? The studios or competing nominees?
It's a mixture of both, but I think it's usually the competing nominees. I mean, Matt Damon later told the New York Times that the Ted Talley stuff all came from the, quote, As Good As It Gets camp, which was the other nominee that year for Best Original Screenplay, was James Brooks. But obviously, he said the filmmaker had nothing to do with that. It was these, perhaps the publicists that the film had hired for their Oscar campaign.
Do you like apples?
Yeah.
Well, I got a number. How do you like them apples?
Well, the year after that, 1999, another smear against Saving Private Ryan. What happened?
Right. In 1999, the two big Best Picture contenders were Saving Private Ryan, Steven Spielberg's big World War II epic, and Shakespeare in Love, which was a comparatively smaller film. And the first thing that happened was that Harvey Weinstein spent an enormous amount of money promoting Shakespeare in Love during Oscar season, something like $5 to $10 million on the Oscar campaign, which was unheard of at the time. It was usually studios, especially small studios like Miramax, would only spend around $1 million for their Oscar campaign. But he spent $5 to $10 million and really raised the bar as far as Oscar spending goes for ads. But the thing that really probably hurt Saving Private Ryan's chances the most were all these stories that came out in the press that said that the British were, quote, riled by Ryan, and that a group of British World War II veterans felt slighted by Spielberg's film because during the Omaha Beach sequence, which is the most riveting scene in the film, The C Company of the U.S. Rangers 2nd Battalion is seen being dispatched by U.S. ships, when in actuality, the British Royal Navy dispatched them to Omaha Beach. So a bunch of stories started surfacing in the press saying that surviving British members of the Royal Navy were pissed off that they weren't included in the film.
Well, the Weinstein brothers come up again. Shakespeare in Love did take the Oscar for Best Picture back in 1999. They obviously didn't invent the dirty politics, but how much gets tied back to them?
You know, they definitely changed the game a little bit. I mean, during the year that Gangs of New York was up for a bunch of Oscars, including Best Picture, and it was really Martin Scorsese's comeback, they even took out ads that said that Robert Wise, the director of Sound of Music, praised Gangs in New York and said it should win Best Picture, when it came out that not only had Robert Wise not penned this open letter praising Gangs in New York, it was penned by a Miramax publicist, and Robert Wise just signed it. And so the Academy had to develop new rules. So now you can't really get former Academy members to publicly endorse nominees.
Well, how about put down a film? Because in 2006, it was a couple of esteemed actors that helped scupper the chances for Brokeback Mountain. Tell us the story behind that.
This is one of the more bizarre smear campaigns waged during Oscar season. Yeah, in 2006, it was Crash, Paul Haggis's racial relations drama, versus Ang Lee's Brokeback Mountain, this beautiful cowboy love story. And yeah, two veteran actors, Tony Curtis and Ernest Borgnine, took it upon themselves to violently campaign against Brokeback Mountain out of nowhere, it seems. They didn't even see the movie. They appeared on Fox News saying some homophobic remarks. And it was most surprising coming from Tony Curtis because he had starred in Some Like It Hot, which is, you know, one of the biggest...
cross-dressing comedies?
Quote-unquote gay films. Yeah, cross-dressing comedies of all time. And it ended up hurting Brokeback Mountain, and it lost to Crash for Best Picture. The other thing that happened, though, was that the producers of Crash also sent out 130,000 Oscar screeners to virtually every member of the Screen Actors Guild and the Academy, which was also unprecedented.
Tell you what, we could have had a good life together, had us a place of our own. But you didn't want it, Ennis. So what we got now is Brokeback Mountain.
Well, we have two interesting, almost side-by-side examples of The Hurt Locker in 2010, Catherine Bigelow's film, when she was up against her ex-husband, James Cameron, who produced the multi-million-dollar film Avatar. And then just a couple of years later, her film Zero Dark Thirty about the bin Laden raid. If you could just tell us a little bit about the politics or the inner politicking of those campaigns, how they played out differently, and why you think they did.
Sure. They both involved Catherine Bigelow films, but they were very different smear campaigns. I mean, the first example, 2010's The Hurt Locker, when it was up for Best Picture versus Avatar, which obviously made close to $3 billion, whereas The Hurt Locker had only grossed, you know, less than $50 million worldwide, and I think under $20 million in the U.S., becoming, I believe, the lowest grossing Best Picture winner ever, although... you'll have to check my fact work on that. But all these stories seem to come out around the time of The Hurt Locker, of ex-bomb disposal experts questioning its authenticity, claiming that it didn't depict combat accurately. And also the producer of The Hurt Locker, or one of the producers on The Hurt Locker, Nicholas Chartier, came out and wrote this mass email to all his friends and fellow Oscar voters asking him to vote for his film over a, quote, $500 million film, saying that, you know, voting for Hill's film would be beneficial to the independent film industry, while if you vote for Avatar, you're basically just patting Hollywood on the back. So all these things started to come out around the release of Hurt Locker. Thankfully, The Hurt Locker wasn't affected by it and went on to win six Oscars, including Best Picture and Best Director for Catherine Bigelow, making her the first woman ever to win the award. Now, the case of Zero Dark Thirty is a little different. I mean, with Zero Dark Thirty, from the word go, it was under attack by every op-ed writer, it seemed, saying that it promoted torture. Frank Bruni, the New York Times columnist, penned this crazy op-ed with the opening line, "I'm betting that Dick Cheney will love the new movie Do Zero Dark Thirty." Mm-hmm. And Bigelow and screenwriter and her partner at the time, Mark Bull, who was an ex-journalist himself, claimed the contrary and, you know, wrote their own op-eds and came out in defense of the film. But still, it caused a lot of controversy. And the film, even though it had, you know, it was the most critically acclaimed film of the year, it had the highest Metacritic score of any film that year, it only managed to win one Oscar for Best Sound Editing when all was said and done.
Marlo Stern is with us. He's entertainment editor at the Daily Beast, and he created a list of some recent Oscar smear campaigns. You can find them. There's a link to read it at wordofmouthradio.org. Well, I guess that's a question. The New York Times seems to have been behind it in that case. Do smear campaigns get set in motion by a motivated party, or do you think maybe the attention that nominees get just attracts a greater scrutiny?
You know, I think it's a combination of both. I mean, on the one hand, films do hire these specialty awards publicists during award season that may have a hand in concocting a lot of these campaigns. And on the other hand, I think the media plays off it as well because it's interesting, enticing copy, and people enjoy reading about scandals. So they are, while they are mostly manufactured scandals, they prove enticing to the public.
We have two big scandals going on during this Oscar season. One, Woody Allen, his film Blue Jasmine, is up for an award. He's mired in allegations of sexual abuse of his daughter and his defense of that. The other movie that seems to be in the crosshairs is The Wolf of Wall Street, Martin Scorsese's film about the, let's say, exuberant excesses of Wall Street.
Right. It seems that from the time it was released, The Wolf of Wall Street has been under fire by a lot of people for basically being a celebration of this shady stockbroker played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And since it's based on a memoir, Jordan Belfort's memoir of the same name, and features DiCaprio, who is this attractive movie star, playing the shady stockbroker and doing, scamming all these people through various pump and dump schemes and living this jet set lifestyle, they think that he's going to be this generation's Gordon Gekko, basically, because, and I don't think it really does promote this viewpoint, and it doesn't really glamorize it. Some people will get that impression from it.
Let me tell you something. There is no nobility in poverty. I have been a rich man, and I have been a poor man, and I choose rich every time.
Two of the films that are targeted this year by campaigns, Wolf of Wall Street and Blue Jasmine, they're both underdogs for Best Picture as it is. Now, why not spend all the time and money orchestrating a better campaign against American Hustle or 12 Years a Slave, which are actually favored this Oscar season?
I don't know. You know, I just think that it makes a better story. I mean, it's tough to attack something like 12 Years a Slave for a number of reasons.
A share of attacks for being torture porn, hasn't it?
Right, right. But most of those attacks have been from legitimate crazy people like Armand White, the film critic that recently got booted from the New York Film Critics Circle. But Wolf of Wall Street in particular, I think it's just an easier target for people. And it really, it deals with issues that trouble a lot of people today, which are that, you know, the fat cats on Wall Street have essentially gotten away with it and keep getting away with it. And so when you have this film that glamorizes this or that people think are glamorizing this, then it can be troubling for the public.
Marlo, thank you so much for your time.
Oh, thank you.
Marlo Stern, entertainment editor at The Daily Beast. To find a link to read more about the recent Oscar smear campaigns, that's at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, we'll go from the dark side of the film industry to some of the most memorable and beautiful bits. A look into the precise art of title sequences when Word of Mouth continues.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. From Woody Allen's consistent Windsor font on black screen to Hitchcock's use of designer Saul Bass, the title sequences of certain films open up our minds and burn into our memories. Roman Mars of 99% Invisible brings us this story of the careful art of the title sequence.
This is 99% Invisible. I'm Roman Mars.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves.
So the teenage girl named Juno is walking down the street with a half-empty one-gallon jug of Sunny D citrus beverage in one hand. She passes a tree and everything becomes animated. It's kind of a lo-fi, unpolished Xerox copy animation inspired by punk rock music flyers.
So how long did you have that main title music from Juno stuck in your head?
It's still there, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. You know what? They're using it on some commercial these days. And when I heard it, I just got flashbacks. It was crazy.
If I was a flower growing wild and free, all I'd want is you to be my sweet honeybee. And if I was a tree growing tall and green, all I'd want is you to shade me and be my leaves.
The title sequence immediately establishes Juno's quirky worldview.
You cut your title sequences to music, so you must live with these songs for months at a time, right?
Yes. As a title designer, it's very important that the music that you use in a sequence is something that you love, that you really enjoy working with, because it can be rough otherwise. My name is Gareth Smith, and I am a film title designer.
Gareth and his partner Jenny Lee did the titles for Juno and Up in the Air, among others.
My name is Ian Albinson, and I am the founder and editor-in-chief of Art of the Title. a website that curates title design.
Ian's site is awesome.
It's a completely different set of people that do the work.
That do title sequences.
People don't always realize that. And I don't always seem to be always surprised that, oh, someone actually thought about this and someone actually gets paid to design and to work on something so separate from the film, yet so connected to the film.
Fundamentally, a title sequence is a presentation of a legal document to the audience.
It's a list of names of the crew and actors and everything who are associated with a film.
And then there's the more interesting and artistic reason for the title sequence,
which is establishing tone and perhaps a storyline.
But there are rules.
When you're doing a studio film, the designer or the company will get a document that's, you know, maybe 10 to 15 pages long.
If you just wrote out the text for the title sequence, it could fit easily on a single page, but
of course, it's this 15-page document. And beside each title, there's several paragraphs of text about how each title needs to be treated.
Like maybe in some sequences, the lead two actors require their names to be bigger than the other titles.
And they'll actually list in the document the exact percentage size that it needs to be bigger than the other titles in the sequence. So it's very specific, and as a designer, it gets very frustrating and challenging to deal with this because it feels very limiting to need to have every single title in the sequence be exactly the same size.
When it comes to innovation and influence in title design, there are two words you need to know. Saul Bass.
He was a major benchmark in terms of realizing that you could have good design in a title sequence. When Saul Bass came along, he was a designer that started to work on more promotion for films and then started to bring his illustration and design style to films. He worked with Hitchcock on a number of pieces.
If the title sequences of Saul Bass don't immediately spring to mind, do yourself a favor and Google Anatomy of Murder, or Man with the Golden Arm, or Psycho, or Vertigo. So good.
What I love about some of his earlier title sequences is if you look at them, they're basically animated film posters.
But a lot of that Saul Bass style faded away in the 80s.
You know, the 80s and the 90s, you started to get the branding idea with films. And so a lot of title sequences weren't so much title sequences, but were just sort of the logo of the film. And so you're creating the brand for the film. So you have Back to the Future, where it's a very iconic logo design. And you have a lot of that in late 80s and early 90s. You didn't see as many complete opening sequences or title sequences, be them standalone or sort of integrated with the film.
Which is not done very much these days. I don't know if you've noticed that, but there are not a lot of films where there's just a big logo that you see on the poster, you know?
But then we hit the second major benchmark, the movie Seven. Its titles were created by Kyle Cooper.
He sort of reintroduced the idea that the title sequence could be its own thing, which is what Bass did, you know, decades earlier.
The title sequence of Seven works as both a standalone vignette and as a vital introduction to the grimy and obsessive feel of the movie. The serial killer in Seven doesn't appear until two-thirds of the way into the film, but you really get to know the killer right here in the first 2 minutes. Kyle Cooper took us inside his head.
The most memorable title sequences are really ones where, you know, there's a great movie after it. If Seven was put in front of some, you know, terrible movie that no one saw, it wouldn't have moved on to influence a generation of title designers after it.
One of Ian Albinson's favorite title sequences is another Kyle Cooper creation, The Island of Dr. Moreau. It was the one that kicked Ian in the head and made him start noticing titles in the first place. But if you were smart, you probably didn't see The Island of Dr. Moreau, and you don't know how cool the title sequence is. But every human on Earth over the age of 20 knows the name of Gareth Smith's favorite title sequence. Making your way
in the The TV title sequence for Cheers. I can watch that endlessly. I remember liking it before I was a designer or had anything to do with design, so I was trying to put my finger on why I like it. And of course, a great theme song on that title sequence makes a big difference. But it also just has lovely typography, very simple, lovely typography. And the editing of the sequence is fantastic. It just captures the entire tone of the television show in 30 seconds to a minute.
Cheers is a montage of historical drawings and photographs of people enjoying themselves in bars.
And what they do underneath each of the title cards for the actors is they actually find a historical image that does sort of suggest that character in the television series. The reason I enjoy it is warmth and friendship. And that really comes across, I think, in that title sequence. there are a lot of fans of film title design out there. I was trying to figure out why that is, and I feel like film title design more than other sorts of design has a bit of a longevity because it is committed to film. Because, you know, a lot of design is commercial or print, and it kind of is designed to exist for a week or 2 weeks and then just vanish from the face of the planet. Whereas film design, you really do have to think about, what is this going to look like in 25 years? You hope that the movie you're working on is going to be one of those movies that's going to be seen many years from now, you know, and it has to kind of hold up over time.
Roman Mars there, host of 99% Invisible. We have collected some of the most notable title sequences in cinematic history, including Vertigo, The Pink Panther, and The Shining. You can take a look for yourself at wordofmouthradio.org. Up next, we're going to celebrate the best of the worst of 2013 with the irrepressibly snarky founder of the Razzie Awards.
Word of
mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Mouth.
What?
This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. What do Christian Bale, Chiwetel Ejiofor, and Jaden Smith all have in common? They're all being recognized this weekend for creating some of the year's most memorable on-screen performances. Bale and Ejiofor are top contenders for Best Actor at Sunday's 86th Annual Academy Awards. Jaden Smith, not so much.
What was your mistake? Trusting me? Depending on me, thinking that I could do this?
Now I'm giving you an order.
You wouldn't give any other ranger that order. I'm not a coward.
Father-son duo Will and Jaden Smith there in a clip from M. Night Shyamalan's latest flop, After Earth, which racked up a total of 6 nominations at the 34th Annual Razzie Awards, or Golden Raspberry Awards. Unlike the Oscars, the Razzies are celebrating the year's worst films, the most pathetic performances, and cringeworthy screenplays. That's on Saturday night. John Wilson is creator and head Raspberry and joins us now with more on this year's nominees. Great to have you back with us, John.
Great to be with you. I find it amusing that the dialogue you just played accidentally references one of the competitors of After Earth for Worst Picture, The Lone Ranger.
Oh, well, you know, they're all, you can reel
they're
them all in.
They're all of a piece, yes. Birds of a feather, as it were.
You know, M. Night Shyamalan has not had such a good record since hitting it big with The Sixth Sense. What made his latest such a stinker, do you think?
Well, let me offer you a mnemonic to remember how to pronounce his name. I always think in my head, Shyamalan's a ding-dong. there's a rumor in the business, and I should say it is just a rumor, that Will Smith, who was behind this movie and is the father of Jaden Smith, as you mentioned, hired Shyamalan because he thought Shyamalan would be so intimidated by Will Smith's power and success that he would let Smith direct it. And if it didn't turn out well, Will Smith wouldn't be blamed. And we actually have a picture we're using in the ceremony where Shyamalan is standing next to the camera looking a little dejected, and right next to him, also behind the camera, is Will Smith gesticulating wildly, apparently teaching his son to overact. The sad thing here is Jaden Smith actually had a career going. He did a remake of The Karate Kid that did quite well a couple of years ago, and Mom and Dad stepped in with this great big sci-fi project that Dad co-starred in and just stomped on the momentum that he had going.
Well, this is going to be the subject of therapy many years from now in some Los Angeles expensive therapist's office. But let's go to the Canyons. Only one nomination for Lindsay Lohan as Worst Actress. Now, it sounds like the Canyons got snubbed by the Razzies.
She's kind of a perennial with us. We call people like that Razzie repeat offenders. And her movie was released in such a way that by Academy rules, which we tend to follow, it's part of the parody that we're doing, under Academy rules, her film would not have been eligible, but we looked at it and said, it's Lindsay Lohan. You kind of have to give her creds. And it's a picture that the man who wrote and directed it has done some pretty serious stuff in the past. He's a screenwriter of Taxi Driver. But it's another one of those things where she's not really investing a whole lot in the character or the story, or, you know, She's Lindsay Lohan. What can I say? I think it's rather sad because she had such potential to do something with the talent she had, and now she's a Razzie nominee again.
I figure I have to find him attractive on some level. You cast him as the lead in the movie.
No, that's not true. I did not cast him in the movie.
You made me cast him as the lead in the movie.
No, we've been over this. I didn't make you do anything. You hired him as a favor to Gina, and that's why he's in the movie, isn't it?
Okay, it ain't no taxi driver. I guess that's all we can say. A first-time nod for the A-list actor and former Oscar nominee, Johnny Depp. He is up for Worst Actor for his role in The Lone Ranger.
He plays Tonto, which is a character it's almost impossible not to be offensive doing these days. The way that he dealt with it is he smeared bird poop all over his face, ran black lines down his cheeks, put a dead crow on his head, you know, Jay Silverheels, as Tonto 60 years ago, was no less offensive than Johnny Depp is in 2013. And it's the kind of thing, one of the devices we use in our show, we find funny but actual nasty critics' quotes. More than one critic compared this decision to do this movie to John Travolta doing Battlefield Earth. So
a perennial Razzie favorite. Here's just a clip from The Lone Ranger.
Eyes cut by the bullets that killed him. From the great beyond, he will protect you. And the ones you love.
You want me to wear a mask?
The men you seek think you are dead, Kimosabe. Better to stay that way.
Now, do you think Johnny Depp may have gotten a boost in the voting for Worst Actor when he blamed critics for The Lone Ranger's poor showing in the box office?
Yes, that was not a smart move in terms. And they did it when the film was released in Europe. It didn't really impact the grosses here, which were rather pitiful. As we are pointing out in our ceremony, the executives at Walt Disney Pictures had to admit to their shareholders that that movie lost $200 million.
Wowie.
You just don't see why they bothered to remake this thing. And all along, the Disney executives who wanted to have this happen were told, no one knows this character anymore. No, it hasn't. The show has not been on TV for 40 years. The characters are forgotten. There's no, you know, other than Johnny Depp, you don't have a reason for anyone to want to see this. And then when Johnny Depp gives the performance he gave, then you've got no reason for anyone to go see this.
Before the Oscars this weekend will be the Golden Raspberries on Saturday night. We're speaking with John Wilson, creator and head Raspberry, honoring the worst movie performances, the worst films, and the worst scripts for this year. Of all the nominees, Movie 43 has the worst rating from critics and audiences. Now, this is according to Rotten Tomatoes.
Yes.
Do you think that those aggregated reviews are a good indicator of what might happen at the Razzies?
We actually have an ongoing relationship with Rotten Tomatoes because we rely on them as one of our three major indicators. The three main things that we look at in trying to decide what's a logical contender are critical response, and as you just said, Movie 43, I think it was 96% negative. We look at box office versus budget. What did it cost? How much was lost? And clearly the leader there would be Lone Ranger. And then we also look at what I call Razzie pedigree, which we were discussing with Lindsay Lohan. Does this person or do the makers of this film have a history with us? One of our stalwarts from the early years, Sylvester Stallone, is back for the first time in, I think, a decade because he had three bad movies in 1 year. But we do look at the Rotten Tomatoes, tomato meter is what they call it, and anything that gets below 50% will at least, you know, take a short look at. Anything that gets below 25 is probably going to make the nominating ballot. Anything that gets below 10 is likely to end up on the ballot at least somewhere.
And what do they get?
I just made six of them in my ex-wife's backyard on Sunday afternoon. They are handcrafted. It kind of looks like a Grammy Award. It's a bunch of film pieces put together, a film, 35-millimeter film core, a Super 8 film reel, and then a handcrafted raspberry stuck atop a pedestal and all spray-painted lovely gold. We like to say that the street value of it is about $4.97, which is an accurate reflection of the street value of most of the nominees.
Let's hear just a clip from Movie 43 with A-lister.
Oh, do we have to?
Well, you know, block your ears. Here's Naomi Watts.
Written assignments are to be done in black ink. When are you going to get that through your thick skull, Mr. Morris?
Miller.
That's a detention.
Naomi Watts there from Movie 43. I mean, this was a star-studded cast. I wonder if we as an audience are even more amazed when a celebrated actor has a terrible, terrible performance.
Well, it's this particular film took years to complete, and I would argue perhaps it's never was completed. But it's a whole bunch of short little pieces that are glued together, and there's sort of a running backstory that Dennis Quaid is pitching an awful script to a studio executive. But it is amazing when you look at all the names that are in it. I mean, Halle Berry and Hugh Jackman, and as you just played, Naomi Watts, and Kate Winslet. And I mean, it's just an amazing number of names, all of whom you would presume know better than to do something like this. The man who was essentially behind the whole thing and directed a couple of the segments is one of the Farrelly brothers, the guys who about 20 years ago did Dumb and Dumber, which I will admit it's a stupid movie, but I did think it was funny.
And Something About Mary.
Yeah. And so that credential convinced all of these people, well, this is the guy who did that. Maybe he knows better than I do. And among the more astounding moments in it are the Halle Berry sequence. She's challenged by, it's a game of truth or dare at a restaurant. She's challenged to mash a bowl of guacamole with her breast. And she has a prosthetic breast about the size of a basketball. And you just keep going, what? You're an Oscar winner. You're a Razzie winner, too, but you're an Academy Award winner. What are you doing?
Well, do you think any of these movies are worth watching for sheer entertainment value? Can a movie be so bad that it's good? It can almost take on a kind of camp cult status.
Those are the ones that I love. And the touchstones from that league would be Showgirls, which is the most amazingly tasteless movie ever made. The review on that one said, at last, someone has made a movie about Las Vegas that's more tasteless than Las Vegas. Unfortunately, I don't think we have a so bad it's fun movie this year. Most of what we have, After Earth is so bad that one of our members said they saw it on an airplane and they were actually thinking about walking out.
Well, all right. So After Earth, poor M. Night Shyamalan. Thank you for the mnemonic reminder, by the way. But do you ever feel badly? I mean, if you ever ran into this guy, would you feel badly about sort of raspberrying him over and over again?
He's pretty consistent delivering Drek since the turning point for him was when he had a script called Lady in the Water, which won him, I think, two or three Razzies and got him nominated for several. And he has essentially, I mean, look at what he's done since. The Last Airbender, which to me sounds like somebody who can flatulate around corners. The Happening, where trees and bushes are trying to kill humans by, I don't even know what logic there was to that. And now After Earth. The man is definitely on the skids. And I think as objectively as I can look at it, he certainly has played a role in putting himself there. It's not like somebody did it to him.
All right, John Wilson. So what does he get from John Wilson, head Razzie?
Ah, you're looking for one of these. Here we go. Back off from the mic. I don't want to get you splattered.
John Wilson, founder of the Razzies, head Raspberry. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
The Golden Raspberry or Razzie Awards are celebrating Hollywood's worst this Saturday. More information at wordofmouthradio.org. Charlton Heston is perhaps best known for his epic roles in The Ten Commandments, Planet of the Apes, and his Oscar-winning performance in Ben-Hur. Up next, we're going to look into one of Heston's lesser-known roles in a film that proved groundbreaking for featuring one of the first interracial kisses in cinematic history. That story when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. We just heard about some of the worst films of 2013. Now to a story from an unabashed fan of B-movies, Dana Gould. In addition to being a stand-up comedian and television actor, Gould was also a longtime writer and producer on The Simpsons, where his love of B-films and science fiction often crept into his writing. Here he shares a story from his podcast, The Dana Gould Hour, about a science fiction film from 1971 that broke ground, not for special effects, but for featuring one of the first interracial kisses in celluloid history.
If you're talking about surviving the apocalypse, or any situation that is, shall we say, apocalypse adjacent, then you've got to talk about the Omega Man. The 1971 Charlton Heston Last Man on Earth sci-fi classic. Based on a novel by the great Richard Matheson called I Am Legend. Sound familiar? It was written in 1954 and tells the story of a plague of vampirism that wipes out all of humanity except for poor Robert Neville, who has to deal. I Am Legend is an excellent book. Such a great fun read. Actually, Stephen King cites it as a major influence, and really easy to see why. Highly recommend. From the Gould book bag to you, I Am Legend. Before it was made into the Omega Man, it was made into the 1964 Vincent Price schlocker The Last Man on Earth, which Richard Matheson actually wrote, but he didn't like the way it came out, so he changed his name in the credits to Logan Swanson, which I think sounds vaguely porny. Maybe that's just me. I really like The Last Man on Earth. It looks a lot like Night of the Living Dead, but it predated that film by 4 years. The only problem with the film is that Vincent Price is the hero. He's the regular Joe that you're supposed to relate to, and that never quite comes off.
December 1965. Is that all it has been since I inherited the world? Only 3 years. It seems like 100 million.
Eventually, he meets a woman, but it turns out she is not all that she seems. Ain't that always the way? There's one really good part of the film at the very end where Vincent Price, facing down his army of attackers, gets off one great Vincent Price line.
You freaks! All of you. All of you freaks! I'm a man. The last man.
The film did not do a ton of business. In fact, when The Omega Man went into pre-production, only 7 years later, the producers had never even heard of it. But I guess the guy who owned the rights informed them. I guess they struck a deal. In Charlton Heston's book, The Actor's Life, which are his printed journals, his quote is, "Screen The Last Man on Earth today at Warner's. Nothing against Vinny, but it's not that much." My favorite scene in The Omega Man is right at the very beginning when Heston, standing alone in a big intersection in downtown Los Angeles, imagines that all the payphones start ringing.
There is no phone ringing, damn it!
There is no phone.
Nice and creepy. The vampires from I Am Legend have now become a band of technology-hating albino pyromaniacs, thus dispensing with the crosses and stakes and allowing Charlton to handle things in a more Hestonian manner. Something else is very different in The Omega Man from the other movie and from the book. The early 1970s was the heyday of blaxploitation cinema.
Up yours! Get out of the way!
Shaft's his name. Shaft's his game.
When Foxy Brown comes to town, all the brothers gather round. 'Cause she can really shake 'em down.
Foxy lady, Foxy lady.
And the producers of The Omega Man thought, wow, those blaxploitation films are making a lot of money. I'd like to make some of that money, too. And so, The Omega Man became the first post-apocalyptic blaxploitation kinda zombie movie.
And yet the whole family can't bring him down out of that
hunky paradise, brother.
Forget the old ways, brother. All the old hatreds, all the old pains. Forget and remember, the family is one.
And then there's Rosalind Cash, the female lead in the film. Off-screen, supposedly, she was somewhat intimidated by acting against Charlton Heston, who was, after all, Moses. But on-screen, she has no trouble at all.
Don't turn and just stand. When I want you to turn, I'll turn you on or off, up or around. I'll turn you. Now, cool it.
My name's Robert.
Your name's Mud.
But they became friends.
You're sweet. It's okay, Tommy. This is the man, and I mean the man. But he's cool. It's okay.
Friends who kiss on the lips.
Now, what you thinking?
Well, you know the old song? If you were the only girl in the world and I were the only boy, okay. But till then, don't bother me. I guess I'm the only boy. You know, it's been a long, long time. I'm not sure I remember how this goes.
The Omega Man has one of the first interracial love scenes in a major motion picture. And it happened because Charlton Heston, right-wing, arch-conservative Charlton Heston, made it happen. I have to say, from a first-hand perspective, I did Bill Maher's Politically Incorrect, the show that he had on ABC before the HBO series. I did it with Charlton Heston back in the late 1990s. And I have to tell you, although we disagreed on just about everything, he could not have been a nicer guy. After the show, I told him how much I loved Planet of the Apes, and I'll never forget it. I said, you know, this might sound dorky, but when I was a kid, Planet of the Apes meant as much to me as baseball means to most kids. And I'll never forget it. He put both hands on my shoulders, and he said, this might be dorky too, but I'd be happy to send you a photo from the film if you'd like. And I wrote down my address, and I handed it to him, and he put it in his pocket, and 4 days later, showed up in the mail. And it is framed on my wall to this day, and I still have the envelope. That is not the end of the Omega Man story. It was remade again in 2007 with Will Smith under the original title, I Am Legend. And I am willing to bet that the entire budget of the Omega Man probably came close to the latte budget on I Am Legend. But the Omega Man is the one that I love. One last little tidbit, and this is a spoiler alert if you've never seen the film. The fountain at the very end of the movie, into which Charlton Heston bleeds to death, is the very same fountain at the beginning of Friends, both shot on the Warner Brothers Ranch in beautiful downtown Burbank.
Dana Gould, host of the podcast The Dana Gould Hour. You can find a link to his story on our website, wordofmouthradio.org. Well, however you choose to do it, enjoy your Oscar or anti-Oscar weekend. Happy to have you with us today. And if you do like what you heard, there is much more at wordofmouthradio.org. You can also follow us. You can send us your feedback and share your ideas for the program on Facebook and on Twitter. After all, the most fascinating stories tend to travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Join us for more Saturday at noon and Monday at 2 on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Zach Nugent,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters.
To subscribe to our podcasts and listen to past shows,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also join us on Facebook at Word of Mouth Radio,
follow us on Twitter at Word of Mouth,
and check out a playlist of music from the program on Spotify.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.